Hi, everyone. I'm Celia Keenan-Bolger, and this is Sunday Pancakes, a podcast to nourish your head and heart any day of the week. Oh my gosh, I am so excited to share this episode with you today. I feel like it's not only a good punctuation mark on this month of Pride, but it also feels like the perfect final conversation for this season. Today, I'm talking to my siblings, Maggie and Andrew Keenan-Bolger. All three of us grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and we now live in New York City. I'm the oldest, Maggie is in the middle, and Andrew is the baby. And while the three of us are extremely tight, I feel like we are also very different in a lot of ways. So I feel really lucky to sit down with them today and talk about our family and our lives and this past year. I am so excited to welcome Maggie and Andrew Keenan-Bolger to the podcast. Hi, you two.
Hi, sisters.
I'm so happy that you're here with me today. I thought I would jump in just and sort of talk about our past year and the way that it feels like it's been different from other years, not just because we were in a global pandemic, but specifically in the way that I think we connected and how often we were in touch. We basically talked to each other every night on the phone for months and months and months. And I would say we were generally a family that would talk once a month.
Yeah.
Yes.
And never like over a phone or on a FaceTime or anything. It was like when we would have dinner, we would hang out
in person.
That's right. Or when one of you would babysit. Yeah. What was that touchstone of like being able to all talk? What do you think that did for you individually? We'll start with you, Maggie. We'll go in order of age.
Well, I know that for me, it gave me structure where I feel like I am not working. I'm on disability. And so my days, while the change from quarantine to not quarantine was not a huge difference for me, it did mean that there was a lot less like going to doctor's appointments or going out to visit friends or things like that. I think that there were a lot of feelings and a lot of emotions and a lot of like things that were happening during that time that were chaotic and different. And to have two other people to sort of process that with, who I feel like we're having very different experiences, but also who I didn't feel like I had to sort of edit much of what I was saying with was invaluable in many ways.
How about you, Andrew?
Honestly, at first, it kind of felt like survival. Like, I know looking back, it doesn't seem that high stakes, but I really do think at the beginning it was a check-in because at first all three of us were in New York and we didn't know what was going on. And I think it was truly like a life check every day that I was doing. And then also I went out to Colorado and Celia was upstate and we just didn't have an option to even like socially distance see each other. And it kind of became a little bit of therapy. And then, like, a little bit, it was kind of boring in a great way. It was, like, really simple. Just kind of, like, talking about what you did that day. It was so kind of banal often. And that was weirdly super nice. And what I do think ended up happening with that is that I feel like I am definitely closer with the two of you than I've ever been in my entire life. And is one of the ways that I kind of measure my success of last year. Like, I think when we took out the entertainment industry, it was not easy to measure your success. And I started really measuring it in my relationships and in my marriage. And like, honestly, the two things I felt most successful at last year were having a good relationship with my siblings and having a good relationship with my husband.
I love that. I feel like I haven't necessarily really thought of it in those terms from either perspective, but I so identify with both of what you're saying. I also wonder, I don't know, Maggie, if this felt true for you, but I think Andrew and I both went into a sort of trauma response when the pandemic began. Do you feel like that happened for you as well?
A little bit, maybe not as much as other people, because I had had, so as like a context for people, I was diagnosed with cervical dystonia, which is a neurological movement disorder, and had gone on disability from work like a year and a half before, I think. And so was no longer doing a day job, which meant that I was already home and also grappling with a lot of the things that I feel like people started to grapple with once quarantine hit, in terms of like, especially people in the entertainment industry, in terms of like productivity and worth, and what happens when those are taken away from you. And so in some ways I felt like I was a trauma responder, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you most certainly were. I mean, I feel like you got us through in a profound way, like especially I would say like the first 2 months that you were like, welcome.
I am also, I'm sitting in the closet right now where I'm recording. Happy Pride, everyone. but like I see right next to me on a shelf is a giant bag of like Wii games and puzzles and colored pencils that Maggie sent me over during like the first week of lockdown that she like messengered over. It was true, like caretaking.
It really gave me so much not just empathy, but it made me realize how I hadn't necessarily understood what you were going through, Maggie, when you first had to kind of take yourself out of your daily routines. And I think I'm interested in either of your input about why being a Keenan Bolger and productivity are so deeply entwined and so deeply ingrained in our identity, and that a loss of any sort of productivity is so challenging to our to who we are. And so I think you really helped us, Maggie, through those early months. But do either of you want to weigh in on what you think that's about?
I think that our parents instilled in all of us an extremely deep and resonant need to make the world a better place and to think of other people in some ways more than ourselves. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
For yourself. For ourselves.
Which works to a certain extent and then really doesn't.
It's interesting because I don't think of either of our parents as particularly ambitious, but I do think of them as public servants. And so I think we all came out with a healthy dose of ambition, but because of that ambition, I wonder if there has always been a part of me that was like, it's ugly. Like my ambition is sort of ugly. And so the only way to counteract that is to show up either equally or more as a public servant, and like to make sure that I'm not being too selfish in the way that I pursue the things that I care about.
Yeah, it's like for as much as you are taking, you have to give back.
Going back to like ambition, that all three of us do weirdly have a kind of sometimes negative relationship to it. And I think a lot of that was our parents not really like shaming us for it, but I did feel like I remember because Maggie and I were performing in New York as kids, and I remember my mom just being like, you are not different than any other kid, in a way that I would sort of be like super self-deprecating about it, where I'm like, oh yeah, I'm not like really doing this thing, and kind of would sometimes feel bad about it, in a way that as I have grown up, I feel like I still have that weird kind of relationship with it that manifests not always in the healthiest
ways.
Where,
like, bragging about it was seen as, like, the worst thing you could
right.
do.
What were, like, some of the really good gifts that we were given? What would you say has, like, served you really well from our parents?
I would say they were pretty good about, especially I think as a boy growing up in the 1990s, I was equipped to talk about my feelings in a way that I don't think a lot of my peers were. I definitely think like the Kenan Bolger motto is like, raise strong women and sensitive boys, which also sometimes can have a little bit of a backfire, but I feel like I was definitely equipped for that. I was, because I moved around so much because I was performing, I feel like I learned to be very adaptable in situations, to be really self-sufficient, to not need to ask for help, and to be really good at like problem solving and figuring it out. And I think honestly, all of those gifts are, there's the inverse on that too. Like I am bad at asking for help when I need it because I think I can do it by myself.
Me too. Maggie, how about you?
I feel like it is fairly easy for me to take in other people's lives experiences without judgment. And I think that because of where we grew up and how we grew up, it's fairly easy for me to understand the sort of societal structures of things and how the world has been shaped against certain people. And also just to be able to, yeah, listen without judgment.
Let's go through your both of your coming out stories, if you don't mind.
Maggie gets to go first.
Because I have one.
Hey!
Oh, gosh. So I was 14. So this is coming out to my mom and dad. And we were watching Party of Five, and they were depicting a abusive relationship on it. My mom said, Maggie, don't ever let a guy treat you like that. And I was like, oh no, this is bad. She doesn't know. I have to tell her. And so I started counting, and I was like, when I get to 10, I'm gonna tell him. So I counted to 10. I was like, when I get to 20, eventually it got to be like 135. And finally I was like, I'm gay. Like out of nowhere, I'm sure. Because I had been thinking about this for like, you know, the last, yeah. And both of my parents who were sitting on the couch kind of looked at me. And I don't really remember what mom said, but it was like all fairly benign. And then about
it was like classic Kenan Bolger, like healthy,
yes.
No real feelings, but like
it's
this
zero
is
zero judgment. It's that exact like zero judgment listening. And then about 2 weeks later, our mom brought me to a Women and Children's First bookstore in Chicago. We like made a special trip and announced to the woman at the bookstore that her 14-year-old daughter had just come out as gay and she would like some books on the subject. It all sort of snowballed from there. I mean, and then I fell in love with a boy, which was like a whole like weird thing. And now when people come out to me, I'm always like, it's okay if things change. Like the biggest thing about sexuality and gender is that it's fluid and that it changes throughout your life. And like, that's okay. Because it definitely threw me for a loop at 14 to then be like, I just came out as a lesbian. Like, come on, this can't be happening. And I think my mom asked me why I thought I was a lesbian. And I was like, well, when I go to the movies, I like the women in the movies and not the men. And I feel like she was a little bit
skeptical,
suspect about that. And
she's like, look, we all love Kate Winslet.
And Juliana Margulies.
98.
Yeah. And Helen Hunt. Those were Maggie's lesbian icons.
Yes. But I like ended up like finding information about the Kinsey scale. And thank God it was like at the very beginning of when the internet became a thing, because I was able to like educate myself and then educate them about like the way sexuality works. And then educate
an entire high school.
In my high school. Yeah.
I feel like not too long after that, she sent an email to our extended family just saying like how proud she was of you for coming out and just, you know, giving a heads up to everyone. And I think we had a conversation about it. And she also brought up the thing that was like, she says she likes girl movie stars more than boy movie stars. What do you think about that? And I was like, wow. I don't know. I mean, names also.
Straight names. People know they're straight. Like,
am I gay?
Exactly. So then, Andrew, how did you both know that you were gay from like when you were six?
Since I was 12.
12.
Oh, mine was since the first day I arrived in New York City for like my first
don't
audition.
Bring your children
and there's
to New York.
I mean, truly, yeah, I walked down 8th Avenue. Now it's like a Shake Shack, but back then I was like, oh, I'm gay. All these porn stores, yep, I'm gay. I mean, my coming out was honestly very informed by Maggie's coming out, which is not to blame her, but I do think one of the Kenan Bolger perfectionism, Maggie had a tremendous, beautiful, iconic coming out where she was like ready to be the educator. She was like ready to be proud of herself, ready to have high self-esteem about herself. And I didn't feel any of those things, even though I knew I was gay. And also, I think our parents were, I realize this is all truly privileged because many, many people do not have the safety and the family support. But our parents were really supportive of her in a way that kind of scared me. I think it goes back to, this is our gay daughter and she just came out as a lesbian. I was like, I already am like short and like a tiny little white boy in my high school. I don't need any more attention. I just want to be like everyone else. Like I do not want to be this different right now. So I did not come out, my whole time in high school. In part, I think because of Maggie, not in a way that I was like mad at her, in a way that I was like, oh, she is like taking my burden too. And she could be the person who wore a backpack with like gay slogans and yeah, all the buttons. And I just was fine hanging back until I was ready. But I think also looking back, Maggie taught me like an incredible lesson, which is one of the main things that I tell young folks, which is it is not a race. Do not rush to put a label on anything. Do not feel like you need to come out to anyone other than yourself until you are ready. And everybody, it happens at a different time and it will happen when it's meant to happen. But it did mean that I never actually technically came out to Maggie or Celia. It was one Christmas and I kind of got a little bit of a heads up because I was fully in college at this point, and I was dating a boy who I think maybe Celia met at a party in New York. He was like a little older than me, and he was like, your sister knows you're gay and was asking about you. And I was like, wait, what? But also like, of course. And then that Christmas,
yeah,
we were all sitting around like unwrapping presents or something by the Christmas tree. So he goes, it's so crazy that I'm the only straight Kenan Bolger.
Because you had just
like, gotten, yeah, right?
You had just gotten an eyebrow piercing.
Eyebrow piercing.
And I was
and
like,
oh, God.
I was like, so it
piercing.
Looks like I'm the only Kenan Bolger who doesn't have piercing on my face and who's straight. But I think that there.
Yeah, and
wait, no, go, Andrew. Say what you were going to say.
No, I think I was like, yeah, it's so crazy, right? Wow, yeah.
I think there is something there is something to this whole thing. The fact that you two, I mean, and obviously you are very close in age, and like that time of life is not a time when you're like necessarily being like, let me confide in my sibling about this thing that I'm going through. Like, I don't think that was the dynamic then, but I am interested in the part that felt like we weren't total safe spaces for each other, considering how close we were even then. And I'm more thinking about this, like even in my own, like say my marriage, right? Or people that are really close to me, that there is this part of me that's like, this is not, I don't want to give this, I don't know if it's a burden or if I'm worried about judgment, but that there is this way that I continue to sort of process things without the mess, that I'm like afraid of what will happen if there's a conversation that either somebody might start crying or I might start crying, or like that I want to make sure that I've gone through like 12 steps so that by the time I have the conversation, I'm in a totally healthy place to engage. And I'm trying to retrain myself out of that. But do either of you have that experience as well? Or do you have different versions of that experience?
I mean, absolutely. I think it's like the people you care the most about are the people whose reactions and responses matter the most. And so coming out to either of you, like, was a much bigger deal than coming out to random kids at school. Cause like, and in some ways I knew that the kids at school were not gonna all be like hugs and puppies. And so like, I was ready. Like I was like, you know, had my Bible quotes in my pocket and like, you know, had my armor on and was ready to like fight those battles. But I think that it would have been a very different battle. And Celia, I think I ended up like emailing you or something and you like wrote a wonderful email back. And Andrew, I don't think I ever.
No, you didn't come out to me. So there's still time. I'll do it if you do it.
And also, I think that there's a weird, at least I know I have a weird thing where I'm like, if I can frame this in a way that it's, again, going back to the helping other people, where like I can talk publicly about some of the hardest things that I've gone through, but talking about it even with you two or with dad or with like anything like that, that is harder for me than being like a public presence about it. Because that is like helping me, and talking about it publicly feels like helping other people.
I feel like that was maybe part of, Andrew, what you were saying of like the gift of this past year is that we were so raw, all three of us. And that I feel like I think the sibling dynamic is so interesting, like there, especially with three, where like everybody so clearly has their role. And I think when you're the oldest for a long time, there's just, and also I'm just so much older than you guys, but at least when we were growing up, it kind of did feel that way, that the dynamic has always been that like I was the older one. And then in this past year, I was so dependent on your wisdom and your help. And I think being able to show up in like just as myself with all of the vulnerability and the fear. And I don't know. And I think it just required a global pandemic for me to get to that place to be able to really feel like I didn't have to edit or show up in a certain way that was like, again, going back to the sort of perfectionism part of it, that I could be myself and that would be okay. I didn't have to be like setting an example or something. Andrew, at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were talking about the trauma response of like that, when you were like, I'm having serious OCD about like touching surfaces and just trying to manage all of this in a way that you were like, you know, it's like, that's been a part of my identity, but not to this degree. And in some ways I was like, I don't know that I even knew that part of it. But will you talk a little bit about that, of like just what that beginning time was like, and then
sure.
Sharing
well,
it with us?
Anyone who knows me, especially these two girls who grew up seeing my bedroom all throughout my childhood.
We'd never believe it.
The fact that I had OCD would be truly shocking. Yeah, I
used to sleep in a closed basket.
It was covered in stuff.
This is too much on the bed. yeah, I recently was, I know it's like the most overused phrase of the past couple of years, but like I discovered I had anxiety, like pretty badly. And all of that was sort of culminating like in the few months before the pandemic. And I think the pandemic came upon and it just sort of snapped the tether. So yeah, I also viewed our check-ins as like a lot of therapy, because I hadn't really been set up with a good therapist who I could then go remotely. But I also do think one reason I think that the three of us turned each other, one of the reasons that the three of us turned to each other is because we do have a shared trauma, and that when we were younger, our mom got sick with cancer and died. And so I think part of that emergency response was like, this is the second scariest thing that seems to have happened. I can remember one that was frankly a lot scarier. And who were the people who were around me at that point?
I totally agree with that, Andrew. And I feel like even like those very early days when William had spring break, and so we were just going to go upstate. We were like, we'll just go upstate for 2 weeks and then we'll come back and everything will be back to normal. But that as I was packing our bag to like go upstate, in my head, I was like, pack like you're never going to get to come back to this apartment. And I told that to my therapist and she was like, that's not a normal mm-hmm. response. And I was like, really? And I do think that when you have experienced loss, and you guys were, how old were you when our mom got sick?
I was 13.
Yeah, I was 11, 12.
I'm just thinking of my own child. Like, that's not that far away from his age. But that when you are faced with something at such a young age, the fight or flight and the anxiety, I think, is just right, always living a little bit under the, like, right at the surface and waiting for any event or number of events to come around so that it can just like peek its head out. Do you feel like, Andrew, how is your anxiety showing up before, and how did you feel like you've gained anything in the past year around how to manage it?
Yeah, I feel like honestly a lot of my anxiety is based on like the internet. And sort of an unhealthy relationship with it. And it's not necessarily like people talking trash about me. I get anxiety when I see anyone talking bad about anyone on the internet. Like, it will really send me. And I'm sure it's because of experiences that I have had. But I'll tell you what, last year was not a great year to witness a lot of people having like internet feuds. And so I definitely, the main thing, I like a lot of people this past year, I did the Artist's Way, and we had to like draw our monster. And my monster for anxiety was just a laptop with like a scary demon face on it.
I think we all have pretty different, but we have different experiences of this. But as we are trying to reflect on the last year, Maggie, will you talk about how it feels for the world to be starting up again?
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, and I think a lot of people with disabilities, it's a common theme where it's kind of bittersweet, where there's a lot of talk about like going back, and I'm not really going back to anything where it's like, this was my life before, and it was during quarantine, and things certainly are going to change a little bit, and like, I've been able to have more friends over and things, which is awesome. Not only am I not going back to things, but also a lot of the like accessible things that got put into place while COVID was happening are now being taken away. Which seems counterintuitive, where it's like, if you have opened up a way to give people
access,
yeah, like, keep it there, we want it, we need it. But unfortunately, I think money and money always sort of is the main factor in like what people are able to do or interested in doing.
How about for you, Andrew?
One of the main things that I noticed about the lockdown that I realized I actually kind of like was, it was the first time, I think, in my professional career that everyone was sort of in the same boat. We were all unemployed. We all were out of a job. There was no, like, hierarchy. And it felt like a shared kind of nice thing. Like, I wasn't not getting auditions because I didn't have enough film credits, or I wasn't, like, too short, or, like, not a good enough singer. And I am worried, I feel like entering back into the workforce, that we're just going to pretend like that never happened and revert back to all the things that, like, jealousy and comparing yourself and your careers to other people, that will creep back in. That makes me a little nervous.
We are about to come up on the anniversary of our mom having been dead for 20 years. And I mean, what about that? I feel in some ways like, because this last year was so long and felt so strange, I feel kind of disconnected from it. And maybe that would be the case anyway if we just had a normal year last year. But when I think about like those early years right after she died and like how painful, even like this time, like June, whatever it is, like 9th, I would have started to like, because I think right before she died, you guys both came and visited me in California. I had a job in California. It was like one of the first jobs that I think it was the first job I had out of college, but it was the first time that we ever traveled by ourselves, like just the three of us. Is that right?
I think so.
That the two of you just came and visited me without a grown up. And I would, you know, in the years right after she died, I would start like playing the tape of like, okay, this is around the time when Andrew and Maggie came to visit, and this is when we read Me Talk Pretty One Day Under a Tree, and this is when a cat ran into our apartment because we kept not shutting the screen door. But like all of it was its own sort of really, really painful revisiting of this day. And now I'm like 20 years later, there are some times when coming up on the date, I'm like, God, I feel like shit. And then I'm like, oh, I wonder if it's because we're like approaching that anniversary. But for the most part, like how are you feeling now? And just in the past, like how has the leading up to that time been? Or is the anniversary not as loaded for you as it is for me?
I feel like I have had some real meltdowns about our mom's death in the past couple years. I think we had two Mother's Days, basically 2020 and 21. And for whatever reason, I was just an asshole to my husband. It was just like bad. And both days I was like, oh shit. Yeah. I had forgotten that I had been getting like a constant stream, like on Instagram, of like everyone sharing their mom's photos. It's funny, there are some years that her anniversary will come and go and I don't even remember them. And then years where like that whole week I will be wrecked and I have not found any kind of pattern or rhythm. And sometimes it's when I'm happy that like I get the most sad because she's not there. And sometimes it's when I'm like depressed because we can't talk to her. yeah, it's just, I think it's something we'll carry around forever. And I feel lucky that at least we have, like, the three of us as a family unit to, like, have that kind of shared experience.
Yeah, it's very strange to think about the fact that so many people in my life now don't know her, never met her, have no context for her whatsoever. There's a graphic that I really like that is about grief, that is a box with a ball in it and a little button on the side. And basically, the idea is that when someone first dies, the ball is huge. And so the ball hits the button quite a lot. And then as time goes on, the ball shrinks. And so it hits it a little bit less, but it's still totally random. Like, you still don't know when or why that ball is going to hit the button. And it's, that ball is still present. Like, there's always going to be that ball, like, jangling around in there. And that button, that grief button that's going to be pressed for whatever reason. And I feel like that's always the case. I mean, I had a dear friend die at the very beginning of quarantine. I feel like that brought up a lot of stuff about our mom and thinking about that and the ways that we grieve and the ways that we don't grieve. I'm still hoping at some point to do a book about, like, practical things you can do to help people when people die, because I think that it's something that is so under it's not talked about in our society, and it is,
and yet the most universal experience.
Everyone.
The only inevitability.
You know, when we were 17 and 16, and Celia, 17 plus 6, how old were you? 23. So we needed a book. We needed, like, someone to have, like, very specific instructions on, like, here's ways to help and here are ways that you do not help. And I think that those things are different for everyone, but certainly there are some, like, universal things that are useful.
It also, I like the idea of that because it makes me feel like it doesn't fall. I sometimes think it falls to the person who is dying to teach, like, that some of my resentment feels like a strong word, but that I feel like because our mother in her despair was so important to her that she be strong, that she be healthy in her communication, that she be present, but not messy in the way that she died. And I would say that we all really metabolize that in the way that we grieved and continue to grieve, that there's not a lot of mess. I mean, for as close as we are, I'm thinking about this, that, like, I remember Michelle Obama in her book, she talked about after her dad died and how they all just, like, sat around the table and sobbed. And I was like,
yeah, we did not have that.
That sounds, no, not even close. And I think everybody shows up in different ways around death, and it's not up to our dying mother to be like, it's okay to, like, talk about how hard this is. And I think now being a parent, when I think about, I think that's been one of the hardest parts of, like, I'm going to cry, of motherhood, that, like, what it probably felt like to, like, be trying to take care of herself and also being like, oh my God, I'm going to miss out on so much, but I can't really let them see that. And, like, what a burden that is. And I think because she did not give over to it, we were all in her, like, trying to uphold her wishes and be like, we're also strong. We can be strong as you're dying and we can be strong after you're dying. But then when a global pandemic hits, we're going to go into a real trauma response because there's all kinds of grief that hasn't been really processed. And obviously that's just life's work. But I'm so interested going forward. And I think it is born out of this year that I'm like, I want more places to process and to have to process grief and understand spaces for healing. Because as a culture, we are just not set up for it. Like we don't want to talk about it, and we don't want to burden other people with our messy feelings. Sorry, I cried, guys.
Please apologize for the thing that you're talking about trying to create more of.
Celia, the narrative that I've sort of told myself and like told other people is that after our mother died, we were like really lucky that Maggie and I had an older sister who then like came in to be kind of our surrogate mother, and that one of the greatest gifts that our mom gave us was like having us be nice to each other so that when we grew up, we were able to take care of each other. Do you feel like at that time you felt that pressure to be like, I gotta save the family unit? Or was it, what was going on there?
I think I felt so happy to have the two of you. And I think, in fact, taking that role on made me feel not only like I was doing what our mom would have wanted, and I think that was even subconscious, but that I had purpose, that I was like helpful in our family. I felt none of the pressure or like anything that was difficult about that. I think what I'm realizing and what I certainly came face to face with in motherhood was a realization that I had, in fact, been taking care of people for a long time. And totally by my own choice and with very little. And the way that, I mean, you both, it's not like I was like,
you were changing our diapers, yes.
But that when you fancy yourself a caregiver, or when you feel like you have good tools for that, I think you step into that role. I think our mom dying helped me then. When I would go into spaces, I was like, I know that I love taking care of my siblings. I know that I will love taking care of this cast. I know that I will love taking care of this group of people. And so that when I finally became a mother, and I think all of that information led me to think that I was going to be a really baller mom. And I was like, I'm going to love it. I'm going to be good at it. And then I had a baby and I was like, oh my God, this is not how I thought I would feel. I felt overwhelmed and I felt exhausted too early on, I think. And I think the greatest gift of that, of William being born, was that I was able to like turn that burden over to the two of you, that like the two people that I really felt like I could show up as myself and say, like, I'm really struggling and I really don't know what I've done to my life. I could both share that with you. And I felt like the role of me as the caregiver completely changed, and that you two took care of me. And like, what a crazy but beautiful gift to be given in the middle of, I would say, one of the hardest times or one of the hardest transitions of my life. And I would say in a lot of ways that I feel like now our dynamic is much more equal, because I feel like there is so much care coming from both of you, both towards me and towards my child who worships both of you. And so I think for whatever the leading up to all of it was, the way that it has like settled now is really, really beautiful. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
So I know all of us have different family dynamics, and I hope for those of you whose family of origin is complicated, you've been able to create found families that give you the kind of support and love that we all deserve. I keep thinking about the part of the conversation where we talked about how hard it is to share intimate and vulnerable things with our family. And honestly, this podcast gave me some insights and understanding about my siblings' lives that we had never talked about. And I think sometimes because as families, we can experience the same events very differently, it can make them hard to talk about. But as I was sitting in this interview, it makes me wonder if, as an exercise, it would be easier if we had a sort of StoryCorps approach where we asked questions or interviewed the people that we love in a more formal way. I feel like it would make it less awkward and maybe we could learn some things along the way. Okay, I sourced my siblings for the weekly roundup this week and they gave me the goods. The first is Andrew's and he recommends the White Horse episode from the Memory Place podcast. And it's about the oldest gay bar in the nation. It was recorded in the days following the Pulse massacre and re-airs every year on its anniversary. The second is Maggie's Rec, and it's a Black disabled artist called Rana, and she creates digital art pertaining to chronic illness, self-love, mental health, and anti-racism, and her work is really, really beautiful. And then finally, mine is the StoryCorps website, which has this great list of questions like, how has your life been different than you imagined? Or are there things about me that you've always wanted to know but have never asked that I thought you could maybe use if you wanted to interview someone in your family? I'm also including one of my favorite StoryCorps interviews where a young mother talks to her son about her own mother who died 2 weeks after he was born. Okay. That's all for this week. This is our last conversation, but I could not bear to finish without a season roundup. So there's going to be a mini-sode dropping this week as the final episode. I cannot wait for that. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. This week's episode was recorded in New York on the lands of the Lenape peoples. Sunday Pancakes is produced by me and Rachel Sussman of Plate Spinner Productions, with editing and engineering by Tim Kashani and Ali Rice of Apples and Oranges Arts. The theme music is by Gavin Creel. Special thanks this week to John Conley and my dad, Rory Bulger, whose compassion, non-judgmental listening, and public service continues to inspire me. Sunday Pancakes is distributed by Playbill.